Welcome. You are listening to The Creative Spark. My name is G. Brian Benson, and I'm an award-winning author, project coach, actor, TEDx speaker, creative, and four-time Ironman triathlete. I love to creatively inspire and be inspired. And with each episode, I will be talking of authors, athletes, entrepreneurs, artists, and actors sharing their journey of success and learning how to find the joy and peace of mind that comes with stepping into one's own skin and going beyond anything they might previously have thought possible. I hope that their stories and strategies provide insight, tools, and empowerment to step up your creative game and help you live your best life. So without further ado, let's get going. Welcome to The Creative Spark. This week's guest, James Darnborough, is a London-born author, painter, and actor currently living in Los Angeles, California. James brings a wealth of talent and creative energy to everything he becomes involved in. James' recent book, The Gambler's Game, is a book about his American grandfather, Bill Darnborough, who was born in Illinois in 1869 and was a Midwestern baseball player turned professional roulette player and is the only American in history to break the bank at Monte Carlo. After spending 35 years in the media business, including magazine publishing in London, New York, Sydney, and Johannesburg, James is now focusing on his creative pursuits. Welcome, James.
Hi, Brian. It's great to be here. Thanks.
It's been too long. It's probably been five or six years since we've had a proper chat. We knew each other in LA.
Yep.
And so much has happened for you since then. We both found our creative gifts later in life. How has that changed you as a person?
Oh, completely. So I was really in the rat race, 30 odd years on the corporate side of media business. And for a large amount of that time, you know, I'd wear a suit every day and go into the office. And it was all about budgets and finance and distribution and demographics and all of that stuff. And I had a lot of fun. Let's be honest. I mean,
you're traveling all over the world.
I went around the world. I mean, I was in South Africa when Mandela was released and went to that rugby final and saw a huge change in that country. And I was the publisher of the Rugby World Cup magazine at the time, which meant I got to get invited to all the VIP things. And so it was, you know, it was pretty good. And I loved Australia and I loved New York. But, you know, that was what I thought was my lot in life, was to just be, you know, chasing the next contract. And the creative thing, actually, I believe it or not, I have COVID to thank for this, because I was in LA and COVID happened and everyone's getting on social media. And apart from the obvious, like stay safe and everything, it was, what are we going to do now?
Yeah.
Allowed to leave our homes.
Yeah, I was there too. I totally know what you mean.
Yeah, sure. So everyone was going, oh, I'm going to, you know, learn Mandarin. And all these really ambitious, lofty ideals, and then they'd end up watching Game of Thrones for the third time or something. It was just extraordinary. I got this email from someone in the UK who was writing a book about US Air Force bases that were in southern England and eastern England during the Second World War. And this is so random. He said, my father was a film producer and he'd made a film using one of these bases back in the 50s. Mm. And he said, I need to know more about it. What do you know? And I said, I don't know anything. You know, unfortunately, my father passed away a long time ago. And, you know, whatever you found on the internet, I'm sure I can't elaborate on that. Mm. And anyway, we just exchanged, you know, some nice, pleasant emails. And then one day an email arrived and he said, I hope you don't mind. I Googled you, which is a very English way of saying things. And he said, you're the grandson of the American that broke the Bank of Monte Carlo. That's Unbelievable. And you live in Hollywood. So why are you still sitting around? You need to write the screenplay about this. It's going to be a blockbuster. And I'm sure you know everybody in the film business. And I'm thinking, yeah, right. Got Chris Nolan on speed dial. I don't know anybody in the entertainment business. In fact, I've made it my mission to steer clear of people in the entertainment business on the whole until now. And so anyway, so I thought, so I Googled, how do you write a screenplay? And then my wife said, no, this is what you've been waiting for. You need to write the whole book. So 3 years later, here we are. The Gambler's Game is out. Now I'm working on the screenplay.
Wow. Okay. So the Gambler's Game. Give us a little bit more information about your grandfather and maybe his story that is in the book. Obviously, we want people to go and listen or read the book because there's going to be a lot more of it. But what are the basics?
Well, it was a fascinating adventure for me discovering the truth, because a lot of people have written about him over the last 120 years, various different bits and pieces, some very elaborate nonsense, and some just vague. These days, you have the ability to get on the internet and do an incredible amount of research, because there's particularly newspapers. So there are people right now in every small town you've ever heard of that's had a local newspaper at some point in the last 150 years that are scanning every single page and making every single article searchable. So you pay small subscriptions for this. And because my name is Darnborough, it's quite an unusual name. So it was very easy to search, and I've got hundreds and hundreds of clippings, because he started in baseball in the little town of Bloomington, Illinois, and he
Like
was
in the 1890s-ish.
yeah so this 1880s, and
Wow.
he was a pitcher, and he was the youngest ever signing for Denver. He was 17. And he was a right-handed fastball pitcher. And and I went there, and I met all the baseball guys that know about the history of baseball, and they explained everything to me, like the mound was created in 1893 and all that. And so he was already in the newspapers even as a kid. And he had a quite an interesting time of it. He went to Kansas and Lincoln, Nebraska, and New York, and not the major leagues, but it was tough. In those days, if you know anything about baseball, you know that they rotate the pitchers, and in those days they didn't. So he'd have to stay pitching in the sun or in the rain or whatever for 3 days straight, every single game. And they traveled on these trains, these long, long journeys, and they had to pay for their own uniforms, and they got no money. I mean, it was really so completely different
I mean
to
back
when you look at the players now.
yeah well I mean back then I love baseball and the history of it. I mean a lot most of those guys were just kind of ruffians, correct? I mean there wasn't very few educated college players. I mean
I mean, it's like one of those old war movies where Lee Marvin goes around the prison to get a unit together of all these people
Oh,
from
that's funny.
backgrounds, and that's exactly right. There were people. There was a couple of Canadians. This is really interesting, though, is that so I can get into the statistics of this and the reporting on every single game. So I can see now the ages and the heights and the places of birth and the weights, right-handed, left-handed, of every single player. And often there'll be an image of them as well, and from the baseball cards. And so I can see the magnificent moustaches. And so I can see all the people that Bill played with in Kansas, for example. And so what I then do in the book is I take them and put them in a bar and have them doing a limerick competition or something, because it's an Irish bar, and then they sing Irish songs and whatever. And then there's the Canadian guy who has this funny way of saying out, and they're always ripping it out of him. And it's unfortunate that out is used so often in baseball. But that's what made this easier for me is that I don't have to be an expert on baseball. There are plenty of books that are look at vintage baseball, and so I don't need play by play. I want to get you into the place, the atmosphere, and what these guys were really like. And I mean, because your observation was, well, they were pretty tough guys, and that's right, they were, and they used to stamp on the umpire's feet and all the rest of it, and then the crowd would raid the pitch, the sheriff would come in, gun blasting, and which was, I mean, it's wonderful to be able to, get in the time machine and be part of it.
So when did he finish playing, and when did he become a professional roulette player?
So we have an outlaw by the name of Soapy Smith in Denver to thank for all of this. He ran a very suspicious casino in Denver, called the Trivoli, and so a lot of the baseball guys would go there in between, off season or whatever, after game, and they had roulette wheels on the second floor, and so he learned to play roulette in there, and I think he was just fascinated. He was really good at math, so I think he was fascinated by probability. That's only my, I wish he was here and I could ask him. He'd probably deny everything. So I was never there. But what he came up with the idea of traveling around America with his own roulette wheel. So if you can imagine the member of the band that has the I don't know, what is it, the French horn or something, the biggest instrument, where
The
right, the tuba, exactly, the tuba. So he's got a tuba case, but inside it is actually a roulette wheel. And so then all he needs is, and the folded up grid, which is, the green felt with all the numbers on it. That's called the grid. So he'd that would be nicely, neatly folded up. And then he could travel everywhere by stagecoach or by train or whatever, and just set up in a saloon. And so he'd go to the saloon owner and say, I will set up a roulette table. It won't cost you anything. In fact, I'll give you a cut of the whatever the house takes. And so if that guy's already got a license for cards, then he's perfectly legitimate. And so that's what he did. And then with the winnings, he would go and find the smartest place in, San Francisco or in Phoenix, Arizona, where he could gamble himself as well. And he ended up owning his own joint as well back in Bloomington. So he ran that for about 6 years, and then he just, he got married and got divorced and didn't have any kids, and then he just decided he just needed to, set his sights on Monte Carlo. So he did New York for 2 years, all the underground casinos there, and they're all still there, all these buildings. I guarantee you, most of the people who work in these buildings in banking or whatever have no idea what used to happen there.
That just fascinates me.
Oh, it is. It's amazing. I mean, it's really amazing. And you can go, I mean, you can physically go to nearly all of the places that are in the book. And that's what's great, is that, so I know the names of the streets and the names of the saloon. Quite often you can find out the name of the guy who managed the saloon, and you can bring him in as a character. So all these people that you meet along the way, I think there's 175 characters in the book, and 85 or more percent of them are real people. So it was a real privilege giving them life. But yeah, Monte Carlo is a whole other thing, and I'd suggest you read the book for that, because
Perfect.
we'd be here all day if I tried to talk about it.
Wow. Well, no, that I can't wait. Yeah, this just I love history. I love baseball. I love just this whole thing that you put together. Now, did you have an idea or strategy of how you wanted to approach writing it, or did you just kind of dive into your family history and wing it as you went?
Actually, historical fiction, I think, is easier than fiction, because you have a timeline and you have a chronological timeline of events. So I know where he was born and I know where he died. And so let's find out what happened in between. And then what I did is divided it into three distinct parts. So the first part is growing up on this little farm in Muskuta, Illinois, which is right on the Missouri border. And I've been there and I found our family cemetery in the woods and all that. It's amazing. Anyway, so the first part is that and playing baseball. And then the second part, this is like a three act. Every book has three acts. Since Homer's The Odyssey. And then, so the middle part is traveling around America and all the different people that he meets and all the little and all the very, sometimes dangerous situations he gets in. And then the third part, which is probably the biggest part, is when he gets to Europe. And so there's Paris and London and the private clubs and garden parties in England and Monte Carlo, of course, and then cars. He owned three incredible cars around 1910. And this was when, cars were all about speed and it didn't matter about brakes. So, and they had all the car rallies going around the south of France and Nice and stuff. So that's really how I approached it. And then it was a case of doing the research and writing at the same time. Because the research bit is interesting. Because I've got one piece of advice for anyone who's doing historical fiction or any kind of research on any kind of project, actually, is you've got to know when to stop. Because it's so easy to go down the rabbit hole. And then there's a whole warren down there. You've got to know what you're looking for. When you find out what you're looking for, stop. Because, and especially if people are looking at their own families. Because the genealogy you can get online now, because everybody all around the world in your extended family is chipping in something. So you'll find your long distant cousin in Germany or wherever, and you'll just want to find out, I think most people look for heroes and villains in their families, and we've all got them. And you'll end up going back to William Wallace in the Highlands or something. Hey, I'm allowed to wear this tartan now. Yeah. So you've got to know when to stop. But I love the discovery part of this, and then putting together the whole jigsaw puzzle was wonderful. And my family loved it all as well because they only knew bits and pieces, so it was nice for us to find out the real story.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's I can only imagine what an incredible experience it was. How did the process of writing the book and completing it change you?
Well, I never had any doubt that I would finish it, and I never really stopped and said, "Oh, you know what? I'll come back to this in 6 months," because I knew that was the kiss of death. And so I read a lot of, like Stephen King has a book called On Writing, which I would highly recommend. It's a little book, but it just gives you a perspective on what it is that you're doing. Because the writing a book is, and everyone says it's like climbing Everest just one step at a time, or eating an elephant one bite at a time. Sorry, kids. The thing is that's all true, but if you're not enjoying the process, I think that that will come through to the reader. So you've got to enjoy what you're doing. You're not, this isn't like technical writing, where you're writing instruction manuals for how to use a particular piece of farming equipment or whatever. For me anyway, this was my process. It was the adventure. Come on the adventure with me. We're really having fun now. And I think that's important. It was interesting though, a question I get asked often at book talks is how much time did you spend on it? Because, there's very few people in the world who can just stop everything and decide to write a book because, you've got to put food on the table. So, I was doing property at the time, and so I was working in the evenings. And then it it started taking over. Suddenly it was 2 or 3 in the morning. I thought, okay, it's time to go to bed. Maybe I'll just do, a little bit of an outline of the next chapter or something. And it got ridiculous. So I thought, okay, well, either I'm going to do this properly or not at all. I'm never going to come back and do it. So this is my shot. Let's do it. And it was the M&M song that got to me. It's like you've got one opportunity,
One
get it
shot.
right and keep and it'll be a movie one day and all of that. So I started doing it full time. But I didn't have any idea how long it would take, which helps because I didn't have a publishing deal, so I didn't have deadlines. So that was nice. There was no pressure from anybody.
How long did it take?
Well, it took 3 years. I thought I'd finished it in a year, and I sent a first draft to a friend of mine who used to be the editor of Rolling Stone magazine, and we'd worked together on a publishing thing, a long time ago. Anyway, he just sent it back and said there's not enough sex and violence, and. And I say, well, you've got to understand, my mother's going to read this. So that was that. And I had no idea I was still 2 years away from actually the final thing. And the editing was tough. There's so many tips that I can give people. Like, writers often you feel like an island. You know this. You feel like an island because you've locked yourself in a room somewhere, and members of your family or people will sort of hesitantly knock on the door and say, "Do you want some soup?" And the thing is though is that you're not alone, especially with something like this. I mean, I'd spoke to anybody that would listen about baseball, about gambling. I got all sorts of people involved. I mean, I was in a basement of this guy's house in Golden, Colorado, and I'd been introduced to him from the guy that runs the baseball museum in the middle of Denver. And this guy has no internet, he has no email, he has no cell phone, and called his landline, spoke to his wife, and he came on the phone and said, "Come on over." And so we're there. And he knew exactly who my grandfather was, and he pulled out it's a wooden engraving thing that the newspapers used to use because you put ink on it and then you've got the person's image rather than trying to publish a photograph. Very difficult in those days. And I'm just looking around his basement, and he's got piles and piles and piles of stuff. And I notice a picture on his wall, and I said, "Is that Ken Burns?" And he goes, "Yeah, that's me and Ken Burns." He asked me to be the advisor on his. He did a documentary about the history of baseball. I was his advisor. Oh, wow, I'm in the right place. So that's the thing is that I'm not sitting in the basement trying to work this all out for myself. Is I'm getting out there and I'm meeting people, and I'm walking in the same places where my grandfather walked. And I went to a park in Denver called Riverfront Park, which used to be the baseball field. And now it's a park. And I worked out where the pitcher's mound would have been. And it turns out they've got some kind of a star that they've put in the ground. So they obviously know. And so I stood there and did some fake pitches. But the main thing was is that I'm in the Rockies now, and it's high. And so you can feel that, pitching like that for hours, days would really get to your lungs. And then, and I look around and the sun's glinting off the mountain range, and I'm getting a whole new perspective. And so this is really important, I think, is that people think, oh, well, I've got the internet, I'm connected to the world, I don't need to go anywhere. Get out there, travel. And it's like war historians do this. They walk the battlefield. So they'll go to, well, we can't go to the Crimea anymore, but they'll go to places like the Somme and the Western Front in France, and they will literally walk the battlefield. And it gives them, there's nobody there. Everything's overgrown, but it gives them a new psychological perspective on everything. So that's what I'd say is I'd say get out there and you know things you'll smell and see things and feel things that will you know it might end up being just two sentences, but it may you know the
But
reader
it
knows.
sticks with you. I mean, I do the same thing. I've done that in different places, like you had already mentioned. And I totally understand what you're saying. And it becomes a part of you almost. And you just put yourself kind of like in your mind's eye, kind of in that situation, and really feel the energy of the land.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, because so you imagine, I mean, even if you're writing Dune, you know, go to a desert in Western Australia, or if you're doing sci-fi, there are plenty of places that look like Mars or whatever that you can actually go, you know, go to, and the desolation and the sound of the wind, and there are so many things, and the sand gets everywhere, and you know, there are things that you assume you know, but then when you actually physically get to the place, it'll give you something else, something more. And that means that you can then impart that to the reader. It's something extra. And you know, and you can tell, you know, it's like looking at research. You can tell when someone's actually lived it.
Yeah, I mean, everything's energy, right? And so it's just that energy is kind of passed on to you through the writing and just the way that you're presenting and it's coming through you.
Yeah, I mean, and for me, I think it was extra special because this is my grandfather, and so you know, I'm standing on the balcony in the Salon Privé in the Casino Monte Carlo, and it's exactly as it was. I mean, it hasn't changed since the 1860s. You know, it's all gilt and marble and chandeliers, and it's so beautiful. A lot of people know it just from the Formula One, but the place is quiet. You know, there's no nobody. Everybody whispers. There's no music or anything like that. There's no smoking. They have had no smoking there since 1860.
Oh, that's amazing.
And so I'm just standing on this balcony, and I'm thinking, you know what? This is where my grandfather stood, in his, you know, he'd be in white tie and have a cigar probably on the balcony, looking over the marina, and you know, in the harbour there'd be J.P. Morgan's double hulled, no, sorry, double stack. He had an amazing, you call it a yacht, even though it didn't have sails. It was called the Corsair, like the pirates, the J.P. Morgan thing. And he used to bet on number 17, apparently. Yeah, he's good at finance, not good at roulette.
This is amazing. This is so fascinating. I cannot wait to listen to the story. How has the process of adapting it into like a movie or a series been for you? Because it's a whole different kind of whole different process, I would imagine, in formulas and such.
It's very difficult because, so the people I mentioned earlier that I really didn't want to associate with in the entertainment business, I now associate with out of
Yeah,
necessity.
necessity.
You know, so I've joined a book club in Pasadena where three of them are actual screenwriters. I mean, actual proper screenwriters. One of them wrote half of The Sopranos. I mean, they really
Oh
know this.
my.
But
Wow.
the thing is that there's no general agreement on consensus because everyone has their own opinion. So, you know, like there was a guy who was on the phone. He was Ridley Scott's cinematographer in all of the great films, and he said, "Oh, it needs to be a feature film." He said, "Write the feature film because when it after it's a feature film, then you can make it an 8-part series." And then, you know, a percentage of people are saying, "No, it needs to be an 8-part series, a limited series, you know, like Queen's Gambit or something." And you know, that's it. You don't need spin-offs. There's no character elaboration. You don't need series two. Just do it like that. And I mean, either way you look at it, I've got a 450-page book where, to me, every exchange of dialogue, every description is connected. It's all absolutely critical to the next stage. And so how do I edit that? You know, I mean, that's the hardest thing is the editing process to me is so hard. Anyway, by good fortune, I met with a guy called Percival Everett, Professor Percival Everett, and he teaches English at USC, University of Southern California. Anyway, he wrote a book which won the Pulitzer Prize. It's called James, and it's the sort of reimagining of Mark Twain's story of James and Huckleberry Finn going down the river, down the Mississippi. Anyway, so he was giving a book talk, and I waited for everyone to leave. And I said, "You know, our books came out at the same time. Yours did slightly better than mine, and that's okay. But I'm going through the same process as you are now, writing the screenplay." Okay, now just to illustrate what different levels we're on, Spielberg is producing his, and
Wow.
so that's his level. But I'm thinking, you know what? If you're going to ask an expert, ask an expert. So I said, here's my problem. I'm trying to create a screenplay from my quite large book, and to me, as I just said, everything matters, and the risk. And he said, oh yeah, it all matters to you though. I'm like, okay, this is interesting. Does it matter to the reader? And does it matter to the visual experience? And so this is a totally different thing now. Anyway, I'll tell you where I'm at the moment is I wrote the screenplay for the first episode, so like the pilot. And I've got synopsis and character breakdowns and all kinds of other stuff like that for a studio to look at. And I think it's enough because going back to my friend, the editor of Rolling Stone, who said there wasn't enough sex and violence in it, the thing is that when a studio gets hold of it, they're going to rewrite it anyway.
Yes, true.
You know, so really I could really, really sweat it. It would probably take about a year to write a screenplay that I was totally happy with. I mean, a feature-length screenplay that I was happy with. And imagine how I feel if the studio says, "Do you know what? Thanks for that, but we're going to rewrite it anyway."
Yeah,
I mean,
that would be disheartening.
if they pay me to help, then great. But I think, you know, my job was to do the best possible job I could do writing the book, and really that's it. You know, however people want to adapt it, if someone wants to make a documentary out of it, then you know, great, that's fine. But as you know, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, that you know, they always say that you must not let the writer onto the film set. I get it, I understand. Okay, you guys, you're the professionals, you take over now. You know what your audience wants. You know, I knew what my audience wanted, but this is a totally different way of, you know, telling the story.
Well, I know it's going to get out there one way or another. It's just too interesting of a story, and there's just so much well-written, well-acted limited series out there now, and this is perfect for that. I mean, perfect.
Yeah, well, it is actually, it's very interesting because it seems to me that there's, I can't believe I'm saying this, but there is better TV out there than there is cinema
Oh, I
film.
agree.
And I think that's wonderful. I mean, the thing is that if, and I totally understand it, you know, I understand the economics behind this and the business decisions that the studios have to make. And you've got to churn out another Marvel film, or it's got to be the top five grossing movies in the USA at the moment are all animated. And you know, and I get it, I get it. But if you want really high quality, good productions, you will find them on BBC, for example. You know, and they have huge budgets that they throw at these things now. Like I think the last Perry Mason that they did with Matthew Rhys, the budget was 10 million an episode, and that's amazing to me.
Yeah,
You know,
absolutely.
10 million an episode. But you know, if it gets syndicated all over the world, and you know, Matthew Rhys speaking Mandarin, then great.
Well, it's I can't wait to see its evolution, and I know it's gonna find a home somewhere, and it's gonna be exciting to be able to see it on the big screen or the big screen
Well,
TV.
you know, I mean, your original question was how did it change your life? I mean, you can
Yeah.
tell. I mean, this is huge for me. I mean,
Absolutely.
it really is massive. I mean, it's opened up a whole. Now I'm part of the Hollywood Writers Club, and I started acting as well, because I'm sorry if I'm jumping the questions here, but
No.
This is for me, this is really funny. So I went for an interview, an audition at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, RADA, when I was 17. And I think I hadn't even quite finished school. And I completely messed it up because I was overconfident. And I thought, you know what? That's not for me. Plus, my father was a film producer, and he said actors were just neurotic, alcoholic, often homeless, psychotic, just depressed. And he didn't like actors much. And he said he didn't fancy the idea that that's what I was going to do. Anyway, so when I was writing the book, I thought, you know what? If I'm going to pitch this to studios, I need to find out how they think. I'd never been on a film set. What's that like? How does it all work? So I signed up to be a background actor or an extra. And this is how I know about Perry Mason, because I was on it at Warner Brothers for 3 months. And I started in the back of the courtroom, and I ended up being an attorney. And I just got addicted to it. I know you've done a lot
Yeah,
more
no, it's very
than I have, but
exciting.
I loved it. And then 2 years ago, they started making these micro dramas, the verticals, because if you're in a feature film, and you're just a lowly background person like me, you really feel like, you're cattle, and you don't get to talk to anybody. You get talked to. The second AD will give you instructions. Whereas what I'm doing now, these little micro dramas, the crew and the cast totals 25 people, maybe. You've got two or four guys on camera, one sound guy, two lighting guys, some people who are PAs running around, and a director and a first AD, a second AD. That's it. And they're all incredibly skilled and professional, but you'll spend a week with them and we'll become great friends. And
Absolutely.
I absolutely love it because I've learned so much about budgets, about how much do extras get, but what does it cost to go on location? How much does it cost to hire a place, and where do you get props, and all of this stuff.
You're getting an education.
Completely. And so I think it gives me a slight edge in that when I'm pitching this to a production company or a studio or whatever, I understand what they're thinking, what's going through their mind. As I'm saying, you know what? This is a baseball game and there's 3,000 spectators. And they're thinking, ooh, we
He
could.
has a lot of extras and a lot of hot dogs
No, they're thinking,
for
what can we get away with? And
lunch.
they're thinking, well, we could do seven and the rest is AI. Or shoot it properly. And, I don't know. I just.
No, I mean, it's I love this. I mean, you're totally getting both sides of the coin.
Oh, it's hilarious. And I mean, these micro dramas are so funny. I mean,
Well,
there's 400 million people a day watch these in China, more than half an hour a day.
now, when you say verticals, they're meant to be watched on your phone,
So
standing in front.
you watch it on your phone, and we film a whole feature, a feature length production. We will film in maybe 12, 13 days. And but we will, we work hard. There's no sitting around
Kind of
and
soap opera type
fast.
stuff, or
Well, oh yeah, it's terrible. It's awful. I don't. People love it. I mean, it's in China, these things make more money than traditional cinema.
interesting.
Which is, this is a dilemma for someone like me. I mean, I grew up watching David Lean and Omar Sharif. The shimmering on the camel in the desert, and I love widescreen. I love CinemaScope. I really do. And I think it's a crying shame that people are watching all this stuff on their phones, but that's the business. Unfortunately, you've got to follow the demographics. And if that's what people are doing, and they're on the train on their way to work every day, and they've got 10 minutes, and they'll just, or not even, if they've got 2 minutes, they can watch, because each episode of these things is cut into 60 seconds or 90 seconds. So it's so easy to just watch an episode and then come back to it later on at lunchtime or whatever. And I don't know. It's just extraordinary. The good thing about it is, though, is and I'm not trying to justify it, or maybe I am, but the great thing is that right now where I am in LA, productions have gone down by I don't know what it is. It's at least 40%. And so at least all of these guys, the camera guys and the sound guys and the lighting guys, they're all still working because of vertical productions. Because There are hundreds and hundreds being made every week. And so, you know, that and the studios are getting into it now. So
Gosh,
you're
it's just
yeah.
crazy.
I know. Well, that's, you know, that's what it is. I don't think that it's replacing traditional cinema. I think that it's running parallel. So, you know, this is, I mean, if you go down to what's the name of Quentin Tarantino's cinema down on Sunset?
Oh,
Vista.
CinemaScope. No. I forgot the little theater that he bought.
Right. You go down there any day of the week, it's full. It is absolutely full, and they're watching Sinners for the fifth time or whatever they're watching. And you know, and so that's great. That is great. But there is a huge amount of the global population that, I mean,
Still doesn't go anymore.
everybody has an iPhone now. Everybody. I mean, you know, the Swana people in Northern Botswana, they have iPhones, and so they can watch this stuff. You know, they can't go to Tarantino's cinema on Sunset. There's no cinema for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles, but they can watch these things. And it's the same with someone in Tibet or whatever, you know, and that's the thing, is that it's because it's soap opera and it's pretty basic stuff. You know, it's a romantic drama, let's say. A lot of the storylines are fairly similar. It's a lot of drama. There's slapping and there's fancy cars and all that, you know. But people love this stuff, and it translates so well into any language or any culture. And so I get it, and it's really fun being part of it, though. They're wonderful people to work with, but very disciplined and very professional. But I mean, it's really hilarious that I'm part of this now.
I get it. I've been involved in a few things like that I never thought I would be doing either, you know what I mean? But do you use your normal English accent, or do you have to pull an American
Well,
one?
I have this really funny thing with my American accent. So people say, can you do this in an American accent? And I'll start and I'll say, oh, sure, I have no problem doing an American accent. And then it'll drift south. And for some reason, I don't know why it is, but I'm speaking as if I'm from Memphis.
That's funny.
And, you know, I'm this refined gentleman from Memphis, so
Yeah,
I had herb or
that's
something.
funny.
And I don't know how, and I asked a voice coach about this actually in London. And she said, this is what we do, is because we like the nice rice mice thing of the southern accent. And she says, where do you think they got it from? And okay, fair enough. So I have great respect for people like, I think one of the best is The Wire. Did you ever see The
Oh
Wire?
yeah, great show.
Okay, so Dominic
Idris.
West and Idris Elba, and they managed to get that accent. It's Baltimore, which has to be one of the hardest, you know, that and Southern Boston. I mean, a really tricky accent. And they absolutely, I'm sure there's people from Baltimore who go, no, they didn't. It wasn't that good. But the
Fooled
rest of the
99%
world,
of
the
us.
rest of the world thinks it's really good. And I have great respect for anyone that can do the swapping the transatlantic. Gwyneth Paltrow in Sliding Doors, to me, is the best American doing an English accent ever. And she absolutely nailed it. I think Angelina Jolie does an amazing English accent in Maleficent. People love using the English accent as the villain. So the answer to your question is, I stick to my English accent.
Perfect.
It's quite fun, because thanks to people like Gary Oldman, the English accent can easily be the villain. Also, the great thing is that, and this is only true of being in America, is that you can be talking absolute nonsense and people will nod in agreement and think that you're making sense just because of the accent. And that happens every day. I talk nonsense and
Oh my gosh.
people think I'm talking sense. So that's quite handy. But no, I think it's actually disrespectful of another culture when you do their accents really badly and make a complete hash of it. And there are many examples. Robin Hood is one, where I
Yes,
just
Kevin
I
Costner.
just yeah. And so I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to do the New York cab accent and just make it so awful that it's disrespectful to people who are New York taxi drivers, who are the
Love
great
pulls from
people.
the story too when we're like noticing it, right? I mean, it
Yeah,
just
and it's the only thing people remember. It's just like you walk in the room, and if you're wearing a really, really ridiculous outfit, that's they don't even care what you're going to say. So I try and keep it as natural as possible.
I like that.
Yeah, I think so. And it's film. I used to love stage doing plays and stuff, and I love overacting. But film is different, isn't it? Because you've really
Oh,
got to
yeah.
bring it in, and less and less and less and less and less, and just try and make it as natural as possible. So
Agreed.
that's what I do.
Well, we're kind of running down on time, but I've got a few things I really want to dive into real quickly. So you obviously come from an artistic family. I guess you were an American. You were born in London and you grew up there, correct?
So it's great thing about doing what I did is I found out a lot about my family. So my sixth grandfather was the fourth British ambassador to the United States, and his name was Erskine, and that's through my grandmother who Bill married Erskine. Anyway, so he married one of Washington's general's daughters. So get this, he's the British ambassador just before the War of 1812, so 1808, 1809. And how's this for the ultimate in diplomacy? He's the British consul, and he marries one of Washington's general's daughters, who is Frances Erskine, same name as my grandmother. And so there's a lot of American in my family. My grandfather, different side of the family, they got here in the early 1800s, farmers, and then he left. So he emigrated to Monte Carlo and then to London in 1904. So there's no so that that was it. So and it skipped a generation, and I came back. So
Interesting.
my father never came to America, I don't think. Well, he may have done just to meet Hollywood types, but maybe in the 50s. But no, he never came here.
With your dad being a producer, did that influence you to get into acting as a child?
No, actually, not at all, because he'd retired by the time I came along. And oh no, not at all. I loved being in the school plays and stuff, and I was good at remembering lines, and I just really loved it, actually. I never thought I could actually do it as a career. I did audition for a couple of drama schools, but that's really because I was just confused. I didn't know what I was going to do, and I was kind of in the army at the same time. And oh gosh, I don't know. And I got into magazine publishing, and when you get your first paycheck, that's addictive. You think, oh, this is great, because now I'm going to buy a house and start a family and have three cars and all that with your first little paycheck. And I'm going to buy a new watch and a suit. And so that I got into magazine publishing, and I had my first magazine publishing company actually in South Africa when I was 20 years old. So I was on that train, and it was too late.
This is kind of a little bit of a jump, but from what you were just talking about, but I always like to ask this question to my guests. Do other people's opinions of your work in art affect you? Because I know you're a painter as well.
The painting was just really a COVID thing that I did. I do pendulum painting, which is half physics, half creative. You set up a pendulum that hangs from the garage ceiling, and you do these big sort of, it's gravity takes over, and you just do these amazing patterns and things. Yeah, they ended up being on, phone cases and bags and yoga mats and I don't know what.
Amazing.
I mean, it's not commercial enough to actually get any serious criticism. I think, I mean, mainly people who know me can't believe that I'm like acting and I'm painting and I've written a book. They just can't believe it. Otherwise, I mean, I've got something like 120 reviews on Amazon, and they're all good.
That's
So,
interesting.
which is really unfair, I know, but there's one where somebody put one star and left no review. And that really bugged me because there's nothing there. There's no, this person has obviously never even looked at the cover of the book. They just go around putting one stars just to annoy people. But it's funny how that is something I remember.
I get it.
But
That happened to me too.
yeah, but I, but I tell you what though, when I was, there was a ladies' book club, women's book club, there was eight of them, and they all got first drafts before I published it. And their criticism was so useful. So useful. After the thing's published, I want you to say only good things about it. But before it's published, I need you to tell me what's wrong with it. And it was so used, like there was this correspondence. They were kind of love letters between my grandfather and my grandmother in England. And I didn't do a good job. But it needed this particular audience to tell me that it really wasn't good enough, because that's not how a woman in those days would write. And so and that was so helpful. So I got help. So I think so the answer to your question is criticism's great when you're in the process, and it's very important. Again, don't be an island. Send out copies. Don't be all protective and copyrighty about it. Send out copies to people. And I had a baseball coach that looked at it and said, "Oh, the mound wasn't created until 1893. You got that wrong by a year." Wow. That was very helpful. And but apart from that, it's really good. So great. So yeah, criticism's good. It depends at what time in the project you get it, I suppose.
Well, for me personally, I'd also it really it I don't know, it just it can tell a lot about where we're at in our own like self-worthiness and growth process too, right? Depending on how we react.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people obviously, need encouragement as well. And it's surprising how constructive criticism can help, because you're doing a good job, but it's a little rough around the edges. Why don't you try doing this? This is the difference between Americans and English, by the way. English always tell you all the challenges and all the problems and obstacles, and just you know what, do something else. Whereas the Americans are much more positive, and there's much more of us, especially here in California. There's a feeling that it's still the frontier, and we should collaborate, and this is who you need to talk to, and this is how you're going to get help with this. And there's much more a sense of that. And so I can't emphasize this enough, is that if you're involved in anything that you feel is solitary, change the way that you're thinking and make sure that you can find other people, because people do want to help. Yeah, everyone's an expert at something, and they're more than happy to tell you they are and to share their experiences. And so ask for help. Ask, listen, I just want you to read two paragraphs. Tell me what you think of that. And they'll say, "Well, actually, the sun comes up in the east," or whatever it is, just something you overlooked. Yes.
Oh, that's good advice. With all the different creative things that you're doing, what does success mean to you?
Oh, success is joy. I mean, really, just living every day. Gosh, what was there was this there was this great song when the London Olympics were happening, and her name is I can't think of the name of her song. Anyway, the song is called Proud, and it's the big line is, "What have you done today to make you feel proud?" And I think of this every single day. So I don't know what it is when I wake up in the morning. But I've got to do something, one thing. If it's just, I mean, something really small, like I don't know,
Making your bed.
changing a light bulb. Exactly. Right. It just it could be something monumental, like calling someone that you haven't spoken to for 20 years just to see if they're okay. And just stuff like that. But I think it's very important, if you can, to try and find some joy in the day. Ignore the noise, and that that's really important. I've learned that it's I Life's hard, and we all
Mm-hmm.
have problems and challenges and issues that we have to deal with. And I'm not saying just blindly ignore everything that's going on in the world. Of course not. But be realistic about what you can control and what you can't control, and bring happiness. If you can't bring happiness to yourself today, try and give some to someone else.
Yeah.
And it's just so easy to do. Just compliment
Yeah.
someone.
Open a door,
When you're
say
in the
hi.
grocery line,
Yeah.
think that everyone before you and behind you has a story, and treat them with respect, And so I guess those are, I mean, these are hopefully the tenets that most human beings live by anyway. But it's to be mindful of that. And never ever go to bed angry.
Yeah, especially if you're married.
I mean, even if there's nothing you can do to resolve the situation, do something to take your mind off it, I watch some stand-up comedy. I know. Just, yeah. It's I don't know. Watch the most embarrassing excerpts of the Winter Olympics, or it's, whatever floats your boat. But that's but I for me now, it's make something. So I'll make something out of nothing. So I'll make a painting where there was nothing there before, or write something, that just write something down. It doesn't matter if no one else ever sees it. Write a poem. I like doing stuff like that now. I like the idea of the, life's a blank canvas, and make something. I do like about this process, about all the things I'm doing now, is that when I'm gone, all that will still be here. And I love the idea that I'll have a, there'll be a, 6 generations down the track in my family, there'll be some kid who will be using his contact lenses to scroll through a virtual library, and he'll find my book and go, "My God, that was my sixth grandfather, the American. Let's have a read of that." And I love that idea. Or that one of my paintings will be hanging on a wall somewhere, 100 years from now. I like the idea that, leaving something behind.
Art and creativity is so important for the human soul, and it just
Well, it's true. It's true. I mean, you think about it. I mean, during a war, this is what everyone needs to save the paintings, right? Obviously, you need to save people. You save people first, but it's so important that, we've got to find caves where we've got to put all the paintings and the books, and that's what we're about. This is what sets us apart from just about everything in the animal kingdom, is our ability to create and to have things that will outlast us. And that gives me great satisfaction, actually.
I love that. I'm gonna wrap everything up with
Okay.
one more question for you. What is something you wish you could tell your 20-year-old self?
I had a really tough time when I was about 20, because I had this little sort of fledgling publishing company, and I thought, and I was in South Africa, which was a very exciting time to be there because everything was changing for the good. But I still kind of wanted to be in the army, and I still kind of, maybe I wanted to be an actor. No, I think I'd stop the idea of being an actor by then. But I was very confused. I think if I met my 20-year-old self, I'd probably say, just carry on doing what you're doing, because anyone will tell you the worst thing to live with is regret. And so now I'm doing acting, and that's cool, because now I realize that it is tough.
Full
I'm
circle.
glad. I'm glad I'm not doing this when I was 20, and I'm relying on this to pay the rent. That would be awful. The way I look at it is that whatever's happening today, I mean, I'm very lucky. I live in California, and I have a wonderful family around me, and great friends. And I wouldn't be here if any of the decisions I had made along the way was slightly different.
Yeah,
Okay.
right.
And you don't have to be ridiculous about it and go, you know what, if I'd stayed in the army, I would have stepped on a mine in Bosnia. Or if I'd been an actor, I would have died in a gutter somewhere in East Hollywood. You just whatever decisions happened, they happened for whatever reason, and I've ended up here today talking to you. And that's pretty cool.
Absolutely.
That's pretty cool. So no regrets, because if you'd done anything differently, you might not be here.
I
So
agree with you 100%.
I don't want to be too philosophical about it, but that's my way of looking at it. It's very important. No regrets. No regrets. You know, if there's something, if you know, if it's like, oh, you know what? I wish I'd joined the parachute regiment. Go jump out of a plane.
Thank you. My gosh, this has been such a fascinating chat, and I'm so glad we finally got a chance to catch up. I'm going to have all of your information in the show notes. And folks, if you want to go learn more about the book and what else James is doing, just go to thegamblersgame.com. I appreciate you, my friend.
Oh, Brian, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much.
For me too. And we'll have to have you on again because there's a lot of questions I never got around to ask you. I mean, this is, yeah, that'd be nice.
Thank you for listening to The Creative Spark. To learn more about host G. Brian Benson and all that is going on in his Creative Spark world, as well as this week's amazing guest, please visit the show notes. We love building community, making new friends, and spreading the goodness. So don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends and family. Until next time, as Brian always says, be well, be creative, and always be yourself.